Hi, this is Scott Wilkinson, host of Home Theater Geeks. In episode 103, I chat with Bob Schuline about his long career in audio and his new recording technology called Immersive. So stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by Cashfly at cachefly.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, recorded March 19th, 2012, episode 103, Immerse Yourself. This episode of Home Theater Geeks is brought to you by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, or TV instantly. All stream directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. For your free 30-day trial, go to netflix.com/twit. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here, online editor of hometheater.com. My guest geek this week is Bob Schuline, a longtime developer of home theater products and a microphone designer, and the developer of a new technology called Immersive, which I'm very interested to learn more about today. Hey, Bob, welcome to the show.
Hi, Scott. How are you? Great to be here.
I'm great, thanks. Thank you.
I must say, I think I've listened to every one of your shows, so I kind of understand where you're coming from, and I appreciate them.
Well, I sure do appreciate that vote of confidence and the fact that you've seen all 102 or so of my shows. You are number 103, and I'm very honored and pleased to have you here.
Thank you.
Those of you who are tuned in live at live.twit.tv or logged into the chat room at irc.twit.tv can post questions for Bob, and I'll pass along as many as I can as we go along. So, Bob, you've had decades of experience working with in pro audio as well as home theater. Tell us a little bit about your background. Particularly, you were at Shure for quite a while, probably the biggest microphone company in the world.
Yes, sir. That was my dream job come true right out of college. I was enamored at the time with making condenser microphones, and that was what I thought I wanted to do for the rest of my life. Well, not quite. But anyway, I started working there right out of college and was pretty much focused on microphones, condenser microphones. At the time, they didn't have a condenser microphone on the on their line. So over a period of years, spent time on that, and we came out with our first professional condenser mic, the SM81, which they still sell, and very, very popular, and now they've gone on to expand their condenser mic line to many, many models.
Now, before you go on, I have one question regarding condenser mics. I was actually introduced to you through Bob Heil, who's been on the show and is a very good friend of Twit, has his own podcast here. Now, as I recall, he's also a condenser, or rather a microphone designer, but he doesn't really do much in the way of condenser microphones. In fact, I think, as I recall, he doesn't think much of them. How do you guys resolve that difficulty, or do you just agree to disagree?
Well, I've had a lot of experience with both dynamic and condenser, and being sort of a recording fanatic at heart, the purity in terms of frequency response, et cetera, of condenser mics always attracted me. And from the standpoint of getting smooth response, for example, and highly controlled directivity, from my experience, that's the way to go. And you can also just take a look at the professional recording industry, and condenser microphones have been a part of it for almost ever, and it's a very high performance. There's nothing wrong with dynamic microphones at all. No power is required, and they're great. And the Shure SM58 was a new microphone when I started in the late '60s, and they still sell it. So, what can you say about that?
No, you can't really argue with that. Certainly you can't argue with Bob Heil's microphones either. They all sound fantastic. I've used quite a few of them. And we should just let everybody know that the difference between a condenser mic and a dynamic mic, primarily, at least functionally speaking, is that a condenser mic requires some form of power, either a battery or what's called phantom power from the microphone input source on the mixer or whatever. whereas a dynamic microphone does not. It does not need any power at all. So in that sense, it's perhaps a bit more flexible. Also, dynamic mics, if I'm not mistaken, are a little more robust, maybe easier, take more abuse on stage and live applications than a condenser mic. Would that be fair to say?
Well, I'd say yes and no. Shure is a company that was very reluctant to get into the condenser mic business for a while for those reasons. And a great deal of the background involvement I had with this was robustness. And at the time, we were introducing the concept of permanent charge or electret, which is very common today. And we spent quite a few years perfecting our means of creating this electret and its stability. And I think one of the interesting comments that was made when we came out with this microphone, many of the traditional German condenser microphone or European microphone companies were really impressed with what we had done, because we had combined a high performance in terms of signal to noise frequency response with robustness. And that continued the Shure legacy of such.
Yeah, Beatmaster in the chat room is mentioning Neumann and Sennheiser, two of the biggest European German microphone manufacturers. Those are the ones, some of the ones you're referring to?
Yes, sir, right. And there's quite a number. And the traditional perception of condenser studio mics was you had to sort of treat them with kid gloves. That was not the approach Shure took. And knowing the ruggedness and reliability sort of philosophy of the company, I assume that that continues today.
Sure. Now, speaking of Shure, you also worked there for a long time on home theater products, which I was very surprised to know that Shure actually was in the home theater business for quite a while. Why don't you tell us a bit about that?
Yes, you might say that Shure ran into an interesting situation when the CD came out and the phono cartridge was not what it used to be to people. I was sort of looking at some new things for the company to get into, and I've been always interested in audio and video. And a few things sort of came together that indicated to me that, hey, there's something we can do here. And one of them was that motion picture companies were creating matrix surround audio tracks for their movies. And when the Betamax came out and VHS Hi-Fi came out, all of a sudden you could get a very good quality copy of that matrix soundtrack into the consumer's home. And I'd been learning about matrix decoding at the time, and one of the big no-nos for any type of matrix decoder is to have phase errors in the audio that you get. So the linear track audio that used to be on stereo VHS tape wasn't cutting it. But as soon as the hi-fi format came out, you could get a very good quality copy of the theater soundtrack. And then Laserdisc came out, and it was even better. So the concept of having a theater in your home wasn't too hard for me to grasp, but the key was how do you get the multi-channel or the surround sound. So we studied the theater decoders that Dolby was making and bought one, and it is not a discrete, as you know, type system. So people generally mixed through the system, so any of the frailties of the matrix decoding could be avoided. And we decided that we could make our own, and we had no access to their circuits and so forth. So one of our key engineers, Steve Jolstrom, who was working on the team with me, came up with what was called an AcroVector decoder, which we introduced in the late 80s, and it became very popular with those looking for the very best. Pretty soon, Dolby developed what they called ProLogic, and we could have qualified for that, but we were a bit stubborn and thought we'd stick with our AcroVector. but we had a very high quality active matrix, as they called it, and then further decided that gee, we should be developing loudspeakers and amplifiers for this system that would be rugged and could take the somewhat more abusive treatment of playing louder and so forth. Unfortunately, the company didn't stay with the product, even though we launched some pretty nice stuff. And what we did sell was highly respected, but that didn't happen.
Mm. But can you explain for just a moment what matrix encoding and decoding is? We're all very familiar nowadays with Dolby Digital, which has five discrete channels or seven discrete channels, sometimes plus a subwoofer, 5.1 or 7.1. But that's not what matrix encoding and decoding is.
Correct. Matrix decoding, in its simplest form, is a sort of passive device. There's no circuitry that has any smart, so to speak. And it was a four-channel concept. If you had left-channel content, that would be left. If you had right-channel content, that would be right. If you had center-channel content, that would be left and right. If you had surround content, that would be the difference between left and right. So by making a encoding device, you could send a signal to each of these positions. The problem with the normal matrix was that it had crosstalk. If you wanted, for example, a hard center channel, you would be feeding a little bit more to the center than left and right, but it wouldn't be hard center. And if you went off axis, it would tend to go to either left or right. Mm-hmm. So the concept of matrix enhancement was developed, and Peter Schieber actually was the fellow that pioneered most of this, not so much for home theater, but for his four-corner quadraphonic. And the matrix enhancement was an intelligent scheme for trying to figure out what the program mixer was intending. So, for example, if there were equal amounts of energy for left and right, it was decided this should be center, so we'll make a device that turns down left and right. So it became very much a hard center. Mm-hmm. And the system worked very well if you produced through it. So if you went to a dubbing stage in a motion picture company, as they were creating the film final mix, they would encode and decode right on the spot, so they could deal with the frailties of any crosstalk issues. And that's what really got this started. Later, when the theater converted to a digital format, then it became logical to make this format available to consumers, and then it became discrete, and all the matrix issues became sort of moot.
Mm-hmm.
But if it hadn't been for the theaters and it hadn't been for matrix enhancement, I don't think the public would have really caught on to what the home theater could be. So that was a happy time, but I wished it would have continued. But later in the show, we'll talk about what I'm doing now, which is sort of my future vision of how to continue something that has similar impact.
Exactly. Before we get to that, you mentioned to me during that time at Shure something about Saturday Night Live remixing, some Telarc recordings.
That is correct. One of the problems that we often heard from consumers that were interested in this is, where's the program material? We knew that movies were a very logical, free-flowing form, but live television, sports, well, that's live television, sports, things on a CD and so forth weren't happening. So since all you needed was two channels, any viable two-channel production system was fair game. So I made contact from a broadcast standpoint with two groups. One was our superstation in Chicago, WGN Television, and started doing baseball broadcast, which they did for 4 or 5 years. And then through some contacts in New York, I started talking to Stacy Foster, who's the high-level consultant with Saturday Night Live, and talked to them about doing this. And they showed some interest. The thing that was interesting is when we first started working together, we would work together in their post-production mode, which would be such that after the show was shown live, they would then remix for syndication and for repeats. And they were always worried about mono compatibility. Because if in a two-channel broadcast format, if you have out-of-phase information, it disappears. So that was something that you didn't want to have happen. So what I found them first interested in was using this matrix encode-decode to mix through. And if for some reason they mixed in some out-of-phase information, it came out of the back. And they said, "Ooh, it's coming out of the back. I don't like that." Mm-hmm. So that helped them, and then worked with their engineers for 4 or 5 years to perfect this. But then again, discrete finally came in, and the matrix didn't make much sense. So the techniques for production and what constitutes a good surround mix, a lot of that was developed during those times, and the benefits of a hard center channel, which some people to this day still don't seem to believe in. But for me, it's very important. My gosh, if you got an extra channel, use it.
use as many as you can. Exactly.
Right. And then Telarc was an example of a record company that was making very high quality digital recordings. And we did one record with them, one CD. I'm trying to think of the name of it here. It'll come to me probably before the end of the broadcast, but I'm looking at my record collection here to see if I can find it. But anyway, it was the only one that was done by Telarc using that process.
Mm. The matrix process.
Yes, that's correct. Mm. And so you could, and again, it was mixed through the encoder decoder. So the sense of spatial and left and right could be maintained. The name of it was Spies, like the spy person, a spy, Spies. Mm. Mm-hmm. And that was that's still probably available somewhere.
But now, of course, we do have digital, discrete, multi-channel capability. And yet, as I've heard you say when in our talks before the show, that surround sound isn't necessarily enjoyed by that many people, as many people as might, because it's actually kind of difficult to set up. You've got all these speakers. You got to place them in the right place and so on. It does make it a little more difficult for people to enjoy what we now have in the way of discrete multi-channel.
Yes, sir. One of my ambitions as I was doing all this was to see more music content created, because from my experience, you can watch a musical performance over and over, much more so than a movie, for example. Mm-hmm. And that made the music more interesting to me. But I observed that even with discrete and so forth, there was not much music being produced. And as I sort of checked into it and talked to people, there was issues of double inventory and who's the market and will people buy it and all this sort of thing. And that was a big disappointment. The other disappointment was that of the many friends I had, or still have, I guess, the concept of a home theater was something I was trying to push on them. And, you know, they could visit my place because I always had the latest thing I could afford, and it was always pretty good, still is today. But I just observed that as many people that, say, kind of bought this stuff, they don't really hook it up completely. You can't help but buy a receiver with the processing in it. And you can get speaker packages quite inexpensively, but that doesn't mean you're going to hook them up. So my observation is, except from the home theater geeks, which I consider myself to be theater geeks, you know, there are some people that have all the right stuff, and it's a wonderful experience. You know, you can worry about 7.1 and try to get some kind of 4K video and all kinds of things now. But the average person doesn't really enjoy it. So that was a frustration to me, and my hope, which was sort of the some of the underpinnings and starting of Immersive, was how can one bring a true surround experience to people that they can use? And that sort of started, yes, use easily. And that's what got me thinking. And that probably leads into some other things you'd like to talk about.
Well, exactly. It leads me into immersive, which is spelled I-M-M-E-R-S-A-V, capital A-V, a very clever play on letters there, which is what you're working on now to bring a sense of surround sound to a wider audience. Now, I've been talking on this show quite a bit with a variety of people about how the human hearing system is very adept at detecting the direction from which sounds come. Even though we only have two ears, and there are the arguments that say, well, we only have two ears, we should only use two speakers. Why do we need all these 5.1, 7.1, blah, blah, blah? To which I say, well, yeah, we only have two ears, but the direction from which sounds come are many and varied. And so ideally, we want to have a sound system that reproduces or is capable of reproducing the direction from which sounds come all around us. And I believe that is your basic premise here with immersive, right?
That is correct. I got interested in the concept of binaural recording 10 or 15 years ago, and binaural recording is by no means new. I think as soon as there were some public telephones available, I recall reading one article where some people in France went to the opera and had two telephones, and they held them up on the front of the stage, sort of spaced like someone's head, and people on the other end of the line enjoyed it.
And I could,
right.
Really?
And I imagine you could also take on a desert island some kind of string and coconuts and make yourself some tin can binaural stuff if you wanted to. Who knows? But anyway, my interest in binaural was how can I make this stuff work really, really well so that I couldn't tell the difference between being there sound-wise or making a recording. And that was one sort of component of it. And that is, I want to capture audio in such a way that it's realistic. And again, like you say, we have two ears, and that's all we need for complete spatial oralization. It's true that the ears are a part of it, but also your sight is a part of it. And probably about 3 years ago, I discovered, much to my satisfaction and a little bit of amazement, that if you can combine an image that relates to that audio, it works so much better. Because often the picture will tell you where something is, or when you don't see it, like there's an airplane flying over, it must be somewhere else. And
we were talking about this last week. My guest was Renato Pellegrini of Sonic Emotion, who has developed a 3D audio process. And we were talking about this exact same thing, that if you see something in a particular direction and a particular location, then that enhances the sense that the sound is coming from that particular direction.
That is correct. And again, checking the literature, I find that back in the 40s, people were doing, psychoacoustics and other types of perception testing, and discovering the synergy between these two inputs to your brain. Mm-hmm. So this is stuff that's been known about, but the immersive is become a way to kind of bring it all together. And what started out in my mind is just a binaural recording process became much more sort of gelled when I said, why don't I combine a point of view video with it? And I might just point out that on the website that we've launched now, called immersive.com, I've got quite a few what I would call educational programs on there, one dealing with localization accuracy. Mm. And in that particular demo, I have a mannequin that I built with integrated microphones and video, and I'm moving around the mannequin, and you can judge for yourself how real the image location is. Mm-hmm. And I've shown that to hundreds of people over the years and get extremely good, yeah, that's right, it sounds where it's coming from. And that was a concern I originally had, because people have said, well, maybe you could use the ears of a mannequin, or perhaps yours, but when somebody else listens, because their head is somewhat different than yours, there will be errors in localization and it will fall apart. Well, mm-hmm. true, there are errors in localization, but I find with an image, it hasn't fallen apart at all. So yeah. that was very nice. And so that's been sort of the underpinning foundation of the concept.
Now, I think we have a couple of graphics to show here.
Right.
John, numbers 10 and 11. Let's see if we can pull those up.
Okay.
Bob, why don't you tell us what we're looking at here?
Yeah, number 10 shows some things that I've been using equipment to produce. You need a camera and you need some microphones. In the upper right-hand picture, I'm holding my own sort of a special Steadicam gadget I built, and there is a microphone assembly in my ears, which is a variation of a professional product called the Sensaphonic Active 3D product. It gives you a very high quality microphone output for recording, and then I'm using a wide angle lens on an HD camera. So that's one way. In the center is my mannequin Dexter. he sort of relates to the program on Showtime, I guess. It stands for Dual Channel Experimental Transducer for Electroacoustic Research. But Dexter completely comes apart. You can take his head off and his ears off and his arms. So that kind of reminded me of the program Dexter.
Of course.
Anyway, Dexter can be used for a variety of things. There's a certain difficulty with a mannequin, particularly when you want to do point of view, because you would like to be that mannequin. So most of what I'm doing now is using myself as the mannequin, or dummy, as some people say, and holding the camera by a variety of means. You can see got a Steadicam here, which is, for those people that have messed with Steadicams, that's quite a learning experience. And lower right-hand corner is another rig that I used. Mainly when you're moving the camera, you want to be able to sort of follow the music and not jiggle things around too much.
Sure.
So the art form starts when you say, okay, this is my imaging device. These are my earphones. Now, how do I want to try to capture this music? Mm-hmm. And what I like to say is I like to try to tell the story of the music. You've got verses and choruses, and often in a verse, you've got a single singer or a soloist, and you can sort of move in on them, and then you can back out for the chorus. I try to emulate what I think would happen if you were standing there watching yourself. And I've come up with this little saying that I say to people, picture your favorite artist in a beautiful room with wonderful acoustics. They're playing some of your great music, and they invite you to come and watch. That's what I'm trying to capture. That's what I'm trying to capture. And I think it paints a mental picture pretty well of what I'm trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of what's been going on is now moving toward, yes, I have the technology to capture audio and to capture video. And by the way, audio now I capture at 96K, 24-bit. And I have a professional Sony HD camera, 30 frames per second, 1080p. That's nice. But if it's not entertainment, it's not worth too much. So focusing on finding entertainment has been prime. I've been lucky to team up with people that aren't necessarily nationally known, but they're very, very good. And they've been very helpful to me. We sort of scratch each other's back here as far as demos, and I help them and they help me. And then we've developed a relationship with the Jim and Kay Mabey production facility in Chicago at the Chicago Public Media WBEZ studio, and we can get access to that studio at an affordable price. And we've been doing some productions there, and I think if you check on YouTube, where you can find most of the immersive content that I have, there is a new recording, the MMA Trio. It's a jazz sampler from Navy Pier, and that's online now, and that was done in that studio.
Mm. Are there any musicians you haven't recorded yet that you'd really like to?
Well, yes, obviously. I'm partial to folk and country and anybody that sounds really good. I sort of have my own simplistic view of music. It should have a melody. It should have rhythm. And it's nice if there's somebody singing. trying to find entertainers is a bit of a challenge. If you would go for some big name star, you have the problem of them developing confidence in what you're doing is new, and it's a risk. I think what's going to happen is one thing will lead to another. I've got new relations I've been developing, the Old Town School of Folk Music in Chicago. I'm going to start doing some introductions there. I like to teach about this stuff. I found a great bluegrass group that I probably shouldn't mention yet because we're still talking. Mm-hmm. And it's I'm not lacking so much for opportunity. Chicago is a great music city. You don't have to go
too
far. But I'm looking for inquiries. One of the purposes of the website is to show people what it is. You don't have to pay for anything. You just watch it. And if this looks like something you'd like to try, I'd be willing to work with you on a probably you can't lose type getting started basis, and then mm-hmm. we see where it goes. And the focus of the website is to educate people on the technique, the technology, and also bring forth immersive musicians, people that have bought into the technique. And there's a contact place where you can email me or cell phone me, whatever. I'd be glad to talk to you. And I'm always looking, we're always looking for exciting new things to do.
Now, I have to say that this whole idea reminds me somewhat of something that Mark Waldrop is doing at AIX Records. Are you familiar with his name or his company?
Very much so. He's been on your show two or three times, I believe.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And he's doing much the same thing. What you describe as sort of a musician or a group that you want to hear in a beautiful environment, great acoustics, invites you to come have a personal concert, personal performance. So he's doing that. And the difference, though, interestingly, is that he's recording multi-channel, many channels, in fact, and then mixing it later. And you're recording binaurally, that is, with microphones essentially in your ears, and just recording it as if you were the audience member sitting there listening to the music. And it'll be very interesting to see and hear the difference between these two approaches.
Right. I'd say the fundamental difference, I very much respect what he's doing, and he's very much concerned about quality and spatial and so forth, is for reasons I explained earlier, I'm trying to do this in a way that anybody with any kind of earphones, or when we talk a little bit about crosstalk cancellation with speakers, can enjoy. So the need for a special playback system is not part of what I'm doing, which to me it's a practical driver.
Mm-hmm. The other difference that I wanted to ask you about is that lately Mark has been shooting the video in 3D, and I wonder if you have tried to explore that option yet as well, or what you think of 3D. You think it's a good idea? You'd rather not do it? What's your feeling about that?
Well, let's just say, yes, I would very much like to do that. Part of it is a cost issue, part of it's time. But my feeling is that 3D is an extension of perception, of visual perception. So when practical, for me, I should be shooting things in 3D to be future-proof. Similarly, when I can get into 4K video, I should be doing that as well. So trying to stay ahead of what the consumer has for playback is a part of my thought process. But unfortunately, I have not done anything yet with 3D, but I very much want to.
Effin Dunn in the chat room makes a very interesting observation, says he could see this technique assisting with hearing impairment assistance. And I know you've actually worked in the area of hearing aids and hearing impairment devices and so on. How do you think that this immersive technique and process of yours might address those with hearing deficits?
Well, I would say that any type of earphone listening, from my observation in dealing with people that are hearing impaired, produces a much better result. It's sort of like talking in your ear versus talking across the room with a loudspeaker. So in general, a binaural headphone experience is going to be easier for a hearing impaired person to absorb. There are some other interesting things that I've been learning. One of the companies I consult for, Sensophonics, produces this professional in-ear monitor for musicians that have built-in integrated microphones and speakers and a processor. So when you are on stage, you can mix in your normal monitor audio, or you can blend in some portion of your ambience, which is a big thing that people have been missing as an onstage performer. One of the people that we've dealt with has no hearing in one ear. And traditionally in the hearing aid business, they solve that kind of a problem with what they call a cross. A cross means that you put a microphone on the side where you can't hear and you mix it in with the side where you can hear. So I had an opportunity to spend some time during the last NAMM show with this fella, and he has a binaural system that has a cross in it. In other words, he can't hear anything from his left ear. So he gets both left and right into his right ear. But I found when he was looking at my video of the mannequin, he was able to do some localization, which absolutely floored me. I said, how can he possibly do any localization? But a part of it is seeing and learning and bringing back some of your skills. Mm-hmm. So that's about all I might say right now. There's a couple of things I'm working on, but it's on a consulting basis, so it's not fair for me to mention the details.
Understood. Before we continue with Bob Schuline, I do want to take a moment to thank our sponsor for this episode, Netflix.com. Netflix, of course, is the source for streaming thousands of TV shows and movies instantly to your PC or your TV through just about any device you can put in your theater these days, including the TV itself, or Blu-ray players, gaming consoles, computers, of course, if you have a home theater PC in there, even tablets and smartphones. You can start watching on one device, finish on another, and it's all streamed instantly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle, all for one low fee of $8 a month. And I found it very useful myself. I'm watching lots of stuff I wouldn't probably otherwise be able to find on disc, certainly on Blu-ray. And the high-def quality I have found to be surprisingly good. It's not quite where Blu-ray is, but it's really very good. And if you can't find a Blu-ray of it anyway, then there isn't much point in looking. And what you're getting from Netflix is really quite good. So I do recommend it from personal experience. And I do want to encourage you, if you don't already, of course, most of our listeners and viewers do have Netflix already, but in case you don't, or in case you want to recommend it to family and friends, you can try it for 30 days free. Just go to netflix.com/twit and be sure to use that URL when you sign up for your 30-day free trial, netflix.com/twit. And we thank Netflix very much for their support of Home Theater Geeks and the Twit Network. So let's see if Bob is back. Have we got Bob back yet?
I'm back. I can hear you now. We have lost your audio, but Now we're back, as far as I can tell.
Okay, well, let's hopefully stick with it for the next half hour and 20 minutes or so, and we'll be absolutely fine. And it gave me a chance to do my little commercial there. Okay, I do want to reiterate that people can go to immersive.com, that's immersav.com, to hear examples and see video explanations of the technique and how it works. I think we have graphic number 9, which shows a couple of stills from those, and it just got posted up there.
Okay,
so, let's see if we can get that back.
That's something that you fellas did. Thank you. I don't think I had that as graphic 9, but that's okay. The site's up and running, and I'd like to thank our webmaster, Eric Motzka for doing this. He also is one of our immersive artists. It's 90% running. We have some more content that's being loaded, but you can at least see three educational things. And then if you go to, this is a good one too. We can get into this in a second. You can go to YouTube and see basically everything.
Right. Now, before we get there, F-Loop in the chat room has asked a great question. Getting a binaural recording to sound good requires equalization that transforms the dummy head response to your personal response. This is particularly used in the Smith Research Realizer, which takes a 5.1 input and encodes it for stereo headphones. Does the visual component of immersive allow the brain to gloss over these rather than having these large response issues?
Let me answer this question in two pieces. I say that the visual helps with any types of localization errors. It tends to minimize those. On the audio side, it's kind of interesting what happens, and I think we've got a visual that, if I can think of the number here, let me see what it's called. It's immersive production. I think it's
number 9 or 11.
Number 11.
Let's see if we can pull up number 11 here, and this will give us some visual to go with your explanation here.
Correct.
There it is.
Okay. This slide at first looks very confusing, but its purpose is to show that if you make recordings with the microphone as shown in the lower center pictures as recording microphone, which sort of from technical terms, you can say I blocked my ear canal and I have a microphone at the entrance. And then it turns out for practical purposes, when you're recording, if you can monitor at the same time, that's great. So you can hear what you're doing. Mm-hmm. So now if you look at that position right there, and then you go up to the upper left picture, if we can sort of scan up to the upper left here, that will help.
Yep.
There we go.
I think that's it right there.
Yeah. This fairly complicated picture tells you what happens when sound impinges the body as the sound would be picked up at the eardrum. That's the T total. And you see that various things about your body influence this, and each one of those is identified 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. Mm-hmm. So, in order for the for you to get all the clues, so to speak, due to the geometry of the body, you want to record at a certain point. Now, you might say, "Well, I want to record at the tympanic membrane." In other words, put the microphone down in the canal.
Really jam it in there.
Right. Now, not that you can do that. And if you are making things just for a single person, you might consider that. But if you're trying to make things for an average person, then you can. It turns out that you're better off recording at the entrance to the blocked canal. So if we can scan back here to the upper right curve,
there it is.
And pull out a bit. That's some interesting observations on me. Now, that data was taken by creating sound in a room at different orientations toward to me. And for each orientation, I measured the sound pressure at my eardrum, the pointy arrow pointing to your eardrum.
Mm-hmm.
And then I measured it again at the entrance to my ear canal, where the little black box is.
Yeah.
And it turns out that the ratio, or the relationship with those two signals, doesn't make any difference where the sound came from, the relationship between those two.
I was just going to say that the curves that we were looking at there, the different colored curves, are right. With mics at different positions, and they look very, very much the same. So there isn't a lot of difference between those two positions, right?
Right, right. So that says that if you know what to use a fancy term, transfer function or relationship is between the blocked ear canal entrance and the eardrum for your listener, if you record at the blocked ear canal entrance, all you have to do is introduce that response, and I would ask you to mentally flip that curve over, because that will look very much like most of the earphones we're going to look at in a few minutes. Mm. That's what you have to introduce, and part of that is unique to me. The biggest part is due to your open ear canal resonance. Everybody has one of these. That's the way we hear the world, with this peaked up frequency response. And it varies somewhere between 2 to 3.5 kilohertz per person. So you might say that what I'm doing is making an approximation, a good approximation to a person, in such a way that a well-designed earphone gets it pretty correct. Mm. But all the errors are not localization errors, they're tonal balance errors. So if you if you played these recordings to a whole bunch of different people, the timing information between the two ears and the amplitude information between the two ears would be the same and needed for everybody. But that amplitude can be tweaked a bit by the individual, but both ears essentially do the same. So you can take a binaural recording, and if you do the same thing to both channels, you don't change its localization. You mm-hmm. can change its tonal balance. But by and large, the localization accuracy will stay the same. So practically speaking, to answer the chat room question, by mm-hmm. Recording with a blocked canal entrance, using basically a flat microphone, and knowing the way most good earphones are built, you get it about right on the tonal balance. Hmm. If you don't like it, you can introduce your own tonal balance to each channel, much the way you would with any earphone recording.
Now, speaking of earphones or headphones, you've done a lot of measurements and research into how they work as well. And this seems like a good segue into that research.
Yes, excuse me. Go ahead, sir.
Yeah, I was just going to say, please go ahead. This leads right into all the work you've done in measuring headphones, including putting some microphones in your own ears, right down next to the tympanic membrane or eardrum, and doing some measurements on those.
Right. Sounds kind of scary, but it tickles. I mean, you don't want to shove something in your ear canal that's stiff at all. But if you go in with something very gentle, when you touch the tympanic membrane, you hear sort of a scratchy sound. But if we can put up the, I guess it would be graphic number one. That would be helpful.
Let's see if we can pull that up.
And if we can just back out a ways to see the whole thing. It's good that you can zoom, but here we go. Okay.
There you go.
Big picture. On the left is a chunk of metal with a hole in it that has been called the Zwislocki coupler. Joseph Zwislocki was a famous, and still is because he's still alive, acoustician and audiologist that wanted to measure the impedance of the human ear canal. Much like you'd measure the impedance of a circuit. And he did his research on real people, and he took a look, so to speak, into the ear canal with where it starts at the concha bowl is the sort of bottom of your external auditory meatus or your pinna, and it's looking from that point in. So you can see the hole in my head, and you can see the hole in the metal piece. And this was a big contribution to the audiology world because you could now design products and make measurements on a very patient piece of mechanical engineering to simulate what happened. So and I have for years developed earphones and so forth and measured them on this type of thing. To back up a ways, one of the things that I mentioned to you earlier was that headphone manufacturers who make great products typically do not publish response curves of their product. Reviewers do, like Tile Hurston's and others like that, but the manufacturers don't. My feeling is that when you show a curve that's run correctly, it's not flat, and therefore the consuming public has trouble grasping that concept. And as we get into a couple of these slides, I think I can maybe make people a little happier. But if we go back to slide one, the Zwislocki coupler, as it was described in the on the left-hand side, represents a model of my ear. And the Zwislocki coupler has a microphone in it representing the tympanic membrane. Mm-hmm. What I've done is I've taken that very, very small microphone you see in the right-hand picture and threaded it down my ear canal and then used some medical tape to keep it from moving around. And now I have my own Bob Schuline coupler. It's my right ear, and it emulates the Zwislocki. So now you might say, well, how do the measurements compare? So if we go to graphic two, I show you some examples or an example.
Mm-hmm. Now, your ear, here it is.
Yeah. In that case, the blue curve is the same transducer, which is a being partial to Edemotic Research, an ER4P in my right ear, and then the same receiver or earphone in the Zwislocki coupler. Now, I would expect not to have exact match, particularly at higher frequencies, because I'm me and the coupler is an average.
You don't have an exact match, but it's pretty darn close.
Right. And then at the low frequencies, you can get an extremely good seal in a coupler, almost down to DC or essentially to DC, but it's harder to get that good a seal in your ear, particularly if you've got a wire running down your ear canal. I can seal this better, excuse me, if the wire wasn't there. So I took the opportunity when I had this working to measure a variety of real-world earphones, which I think are now in two slides that are number two, I think. Let's see. Number four is a example, and number five. So if we start with number four, what I did is I took a number of earphones that were not low cost. I put the street price in there. I don't want to mention names because it's unfair. And measured them in my ear canal. And you can see certain traits. The lower center, for example, an earphone circumoral touted to be big bass. Well, I would say that that's probably true. The upper left is a popular monitor headphone for people in pro audio that are looking for hopefully something that's fairly neutral. You might say it's probably shouldn't have that notch down there around 150 hertz.
I would say so, yes.
Right. So manufacturers of earphones should be able to do these kinds of things, and every earphone is designed for a price and a market.
Sure.
I've been looking at some of the new Shure products, and they look very good using this technique, and just make that comment. The other thing that I've noticed is that if you think about it, when you've got a, let's say, a circumoral earphone around on your head, if you look at the coupling between that the speaker driver in that earphone and your pinna and the ear canal, you've got a much bigger, more complicated mini room, so to speak, than with that insert earphone, the Edemotic product. And I found in general, if you use an insert earphone, since the room, so to speak, is much simpler, you can get smoother response curves. There are pluses and minuses for all earphones. Some people don't like to have things in their ears. Some people don't mind it. I find it's good, and it also seals the sound. It blocks out background noise. Go ahead. The next one, number five, is of the often derided Apple earbuds that you
get
with most everything. And I find this earbud to be quite respectable. If you look at the upper left curve, it has a canal resonance around 2-3 kilohertz. It looks about right. It just doesn't have a lot of bass, and it doesn't have a lot of high-end treble. The bass is explainable because it doesn't seal to your ear canal, but you can also hear the world. So this is fairly well-balanced without having the extremes. The other curve is taking the same product, and some people do turn it sideways and jam it in your ear canal because it plays louder and there's more bass. And sure enough, that's what you tend to get. It's got a unfortunate dip in the midband, which you might not like, but does get louder and has more bass.
This was a question that came up in the chat room. I wanted to quickly mention. These drivers are tiny, so how can you actually get good bass out of such a tiny vibrating thing?
Well, here's a mental exercise you can do. Let's say that you have a tiny speaker, a dynamic speaker with a coil of wire. You know from experience that if you put a fixed current through that, that speaker will move forward or backward a fixed amount. If you seal that in your ear canal so there was no air leak, and you applied that pressure or that voltage, you would either increase or decrease the pressure in your ear canal and hence move your tympanic membrane and hold it in position. So technically, that little driver can drive down to DC if you can seal it well. Now, being able to seal perfectly isn't always the case, but it's not hard to get big bass with a insert earphone. It's relatively easy.
Because of that ceiling of what you're talking about.
That's the magic behind making good bass with those. Now, when it comes to circumoral earphones, you're dealing with much larger drivers, and you have to move more air to do it. So part of the design is to allow that to happen. And also by using a circumoral style earphone, you do tend to get some seal around the pinna, and that helps as well. So you can get bigger bass from earphones than you can with speakers. You can get scary bigger bass. You can actually hurt yourself at low frequencies with sealed earphones if you play loud enough. You just can't do that with speakers in a room.
Right. F-Loop in the chat room asks, what is the best compensation curve for headphone measurements to be used with commercially available recordings? Free field, diffuse field, independent of direction, or something else?
Good question. Why don't we go to the one I have on, I'm looking at my chart here, perceive diffuse field response of the human ear, figure 3.
Okay, let's take a look at number 3 there. When we pull that up, we'll be able to see. Here it is.
This kind of gets into the concept or the question, what should the frequency response of an earphone be? And this brings up another observation, which was called the circle of confusion. I think Floyd Toole in his book, and when he was on your program, was talking about this. And this confusion circle goes something like this. If I'm a headphone designer, I want to make my headphones sound good on music that I buy and have. the people that record the music listen to it on headphones, and they want to make it sound as good as they can. The two of us never talk to each other. So how do I ever get it right? So it turns out that on average, headphones that are well-balanced have certain characteristics to them. And that characteristic is driven quite a bit by what's called the diffuse field response of the human. And that's what I have shown in this slide. Now, again, a little complicated, but let's look at the two pictures on the left. Imagine you have this bottom room here. If you go down to the bottom, John, rather than top, okay, you're in this room, we'll call it a reverberant room, and you're playing pink noise. It's got wide bandwidth and it sort of rumbles. And if the room is truly reverberant, the sound is coming from all directions with equal chance. So now let's say we capture that sound field with that tiny little microphone, and then keeping the sound in the room the same, we introduce a human and we put the same microphone in their ear canal, which is the picture right above that. So if you go up to the top, now we've put the human in the same room and we put the microphone right next to their eardrum. Now let's look at what we measure. That's what we're showing in this graph. Now this graph is the same kind of data taken by many people under different circumstances, and you see that there's a certain characteristic to it, which is a peak of some 15 dB or so, a little less than 3 kilohertz. This is due to the open canal resonance of the human. Mm-hmm. So you might say that if you were recording this sound in this free field room with that little microphone, this is the way it better end up when you listen to it via reproduction by some means. Mm-hmm. So the earphone's job is to come pretty close to this sort of thing, but since all music is recorded differently and people have somewhat different taste, everything doesn't look the same. So generally what I find is that most earphones that sound good all have a bump somewhere between 10 and 15 dB around 3.5 or 3 kilohertz. Mm-hmm. And then at the higher end, say between 5,000 and 10,000, I use the word salt and pepper to taste, you can add or subtract to affect the upper range. And then depending upon your taste and bass, a rise from somewhere around 1,000 down to 100 seems to satisfy most people. But unless you're making specific recordings for you, there is no best or right frequency response because of the variations in people and the variations in music. But from a binaural standpoint, the localization accuracy isn't affected. As long as the two earphones are the same, and most earphones are pretty close to the same, you're good to go, as they say.
As they say. Well, you know what? Yeah. We've unfortunately come to the end of a fascinating hour, and we didn't get through all of what I wanted to speak with you about. So will you come back again sometime?
I'd be delighted to. And great. All you need to do is let me know.
Okay. Thank you so much. Bob Schuline, okay. You can reach him at his newly minted website, Immersave, immersav.com, and learn much more about this new technology, the binaural recording that he's doing, the headphone measurements, and much more. My online homes, of course, I only have one, really. It's hometheater.com. But you can also email me at scott@twit.tv, and you can follow me on Twitter at htgeekscott. Next week, my guest geek is scheduled to be John Schindler, the VP of Product Development at Vizio. And we're going to be talking about Vizio's new 21x9 flat panel and 4K and all sorts of great video stuff. So sure hope you'll join me for that. Until then, geek out.